Even by Afghanistan standards, the tale of what happened to captured prisoners last November near Kunduz is horrifying. Witnesses reported seeing hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda prisoners transferred by Northern Alliance troops. The prisoners were stuffed into container trucks and slowly suffocated to death. This week, Newsweek magazine investigates the story, including how much the U.S. military and United Nations knew. Correspondent John Barry, as one of several reporters on the story, he says they began their investigation when they heard scattered reports about the incident and word of a mass grave that had been found in northern Afghanistan by the group Physicians for Human Rights.
There are many mass graves in northern Afghanistan, and the graves go back, at least 10 years. What was different about this grave at Dashtilaly was that it was clear that the bodies were recent. A lot of the bones on the surface were white and bleached and clearly quite old, but some of them were new, and you could tell they were new because they still had some human tissue on them. And down at 5 feet, they found 15 bodies in that quite small area, and there were clearly more. And so they brought up three of the bodies. The bodies were all young men, and some of them had their hands bound. They were, I think, all shirtless, and they had not been shot, nor had they been bludgeoned to death. There were no signs of physical injury. The autopsy concluded that the manner of their death was probably suffocation or asphyxiation, which squared with the stories that the survivors in Shevagan prison, which is about 50 minutes' drive away, they were saying that these people had died in sealed containers. And the bodies seemed to bear out that story.
Now, your investigation led you to drivers and other witnesses who had been present during this prison transfer. What kinds of stories did they tell you about who was put into these containers?
The drivers told a terrible story. They said that some of the soldiers under the command of, or in the allegiance of, the main warlord in the north, a man called Abdul Rashid Dostum, had come to them at the end of November and said that their container trucks were needed. And so they had been taken one evening out to an old fort, and there they had lined up their container trucks, and a convoy of pickup trucks and open flatbed lorries and so on had come from Kunduz bearing young men who were prisoners, and the soldiers of Dostum had loaded the young men into the container trucks and had sealed them. They'd shut the doors and locked them, and they'd left them there overnight. The driver said about 200 young men per container. And the drivers had waited there all night, and they told us the story of waiting and of these people inside the containers screaming for help. Some of the drivers tried to knock holes in the containers to let air in. And the soldiers of Dostum, they said, had angrily told them to stop it, and in fact had beaten up one of the drivers who did knock holes.
You write that there were special American forces present at the time, a group based in Kentucky, the 595 Aid Team of the 5th Special Forces Group. What were you able to learn about what these men, who were presumably attached to various units of those fighting the Taliban, what did they know and what did they do?
We never sought it out to our own satisfaction because the Special Forces people wouldn't talk to us. We asked them for comment and they declined. Now, what we found was that 595 had been present at Shevagan, certainly from the 29th of November till December 4, and that covers the dates when we know from other sources that the convoys were arriving. And so we know they were at the prison because we have photographs of them at the prison.
What were you able to learn about what various United Nations entities charged with monitoring prisoner transfers and prisoner conditions were able to learn?
The United Nations was sufficiently concerned with the reports that it was hearing that it was the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights that in fact sent the investigators in May that did the excavations at the mass grave site that I've talked about. At this point, the United Nations evidently decided that this was highly politically sensitive and that there were to be no United Nations further inquiries until and unless the United Nations or the new Afghan government had decided what it wanted to do on the subject of war crimes as a whole. And so the UN knew about the mass grave and knew about the allegations of the killings, but essentially decided to shut its own investigation down. And we have a confidential memo suggesting exactly that.
And the Red Cross? Did they do anything?
The Red Cross appears to have been in a state of some anguish. I mean, the Red Cross is an organization that operates in extraordinary and difficult places and does so because it never publicizes what it finds. The price, therefore, that the Red Cross pays for its access is silence. It is clear that the Red Cross tried to, as it were, spark interest in this whole event, sort of indirectly. It was the Red Cross that, for instance, told Physicians for Human Rights that they really ought to go and have a look at what was going on in Shavagan. And when the site was excavated in May, the Red Cross in its Kandahar office produced a young man who was a survivor of this process who talked to reporters about what had happened to him. Now, for the Red Cross, those are extraordinary steps. And we are satisfied that what the Red Cross was trying to do was, while preserving its code of silence, was trying to draw the world's attention to this major war crime.
John Berry, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
John Berry is the national security correspondent for Newsweek magazine.